in an attempt to take it easy. No, we appreciate that Mr. Dali came back safe with his traditional weapon. The submissions as they were coming through via emails. But I'm sure technology has got its own limitations. If you come from a beautiful province such as myself, Limpopo, you may have limitations about technology. So but otherwise we hope that we did manage to receive those submissions in time and had time to look at them. There is no need, members, to adopt the program. It's just a guide. And we have got also a detailed program that outlines the program for the public hearings for Land Use Management Bill, which means that the whole of this week we should be done with the public hearings, deliberations next week and all that. After which we'll then start with the provision of Land and Assistance Amendment Bill. We have received submissions as I've indicated. it's about 18, 17. One of which was from COSATU. asking us to withdraw to withdraw the bill, given the firstly the issue of consultation that there's not been a process at the level of NETLEC around this bill. There's not been a consultation with civil society that includes them. but also that given the 7-year lapse, there's been a policy development which should have been taken into account. There are processes that must unfold before the bill can be considered. And I'm sure we did copy the department the letter, the office of the speaker and so on. So members can also make impressions on that. But otherwise, we did receive submissions and the City of Johannesburg and the Department of Economic Affairs in Gauteng did ask us to extend the date for submissions, the closing date for submissions. We did grant them, and they did forward us the submissions thereof. So, having said that, the program for today is such that we'll listen to the department to formally start the public hearings. And DG, if there are new issues, we'll have to talk to those. If there are amendments that you are also suggesting, it's time for you to do so. But we'll need your full participation to the end of the process. Time and again, I may ask you to see a thing or two as we move on, so that issues that are emerging from the hearings if there's some issues of clarity, I may ask you to deal with those. So hence I'm saying, from now up until we're done with this bill, we will need your office. We've got the state law advisor with us. Your name again? Pumelele. She's from the state law advisor office. So, she'll be with us throughout the public hearings and up until we get over and done with the hearings. And welcome, Muruti. Reverend Mwatum is the chairperson of the Select Committee. So given the fact that this is a Section 76 bill, there's got to be an NCOP process that must kick in as soon as the NA process is finalized. They must take the bill to provinces, get provincial mandates, do amendments, and bring them back to the NCO, to the NA. So, welcome, Reverend. In fact, this bill affects provinces and more than ourselves. So, we'd appreciate that, if possible, all the time, let's have someone, either yourself or people from your the Select Committee with us. without any waste of time, DG, you can introduce your team. I don't know if you've got PowerPoint facilities here. No, we don't have the facilities in here, but I think we all have copies of the presentation. If we don't, let's indicate so that that is attended to. Annalise, are you fine? Okay. DG, what in your hands now?
Apartheid special planning. This is why in this legislation, I think the objectives of the legislation are to provide a uniform, efficient and effective integrated regulatory framework for land use and land use management, which promotes the public interest. And we think that we would like this legislation to provide for and determine directive principles and compulsory norms and standards which will assist in land use management in the country. We would like to promote the, through this bill, cooperative governance, socio-economic benefits and achievement of land reform objectives. And we would like to establish land use regulators and the National Land Use Commission and address the imbalances of the past. So we still believe that those are the important pillars of this legislation. I'm not going to go through the various chapters. My assumption is that all of us have gone through these chapters. We have looked at the land use regulation. We have looked at the establishment of these land use regulators, both at the municipal level, where we are talking about these land use committees, at the provincial level, where we are talking about these land use tribunals, and at the national level, where we are talking about the establishment of the land use commission. So we believe that those regulators at these various levels will assist in this. And we believe that this legislation will assist us to do that. We in this bill, the first chapter is dealing with the objectives, with the directive principles, and with the compulsory norms and standards. This is what we have outlined in the bill. And in chapter two, we have dealt with the mandates of the national government to support and capacitate and provide the necessary ability of the provincial and municipal spheres of government to implement the provisions of the Act. And in chapter three, we have talked about the municipal land use regulation, the municipal and provincial tribunals, and then the jurisdiction of the land use regulators. In chapter four, we have talked about the processes and the adoption of the land use schemes by the municipalities, and we have tried to define the purposes for which land may be used in those various levels. And in chapter five, we have dealt with the operational procedures for land use regulators, including the issue of meetings, delegation of functions, and the engagement of technical advisors. In chapter six, we have looked at the competence of the minister and the national use regulator, the Land Use Commission. And we have, in chapter seven, underlines the functions, the compositions, the term of office, operating procedures of the Land Use Commission. And in chapter eight, we have looked at the general conditions, the general provisions on offenses and penalties, regulations and non-impediment of functions and powers of the minister to grant exemptions from the provisions of the Act, and delegations by the minister or by the premier or the MECs to officials, repeal of legislation and transitional provisions. So basically this is what we believe should be covered in this legislation. We have had the workshop engaging with you, and it is not my intention to go through the issues that were raised in that workshop, but I thought it would be good just to reflect on some of those things which were captured during that workshop. So I'm going to ask Sunday just to highlight a few things of what was covered in that workshop. I know that the report was circulated and our responses to the issues that were raised during the workshop have been covered in writing. So I'm going to ask Sunday just to leave tackling some of the issues.
So, as he does so, he must also indicate the extent to which those issues that were raised have generated, you know, the need for you to introduce some amendments or not.
Thank you, Chair. We had initially circulated our responses to the questions as we got them from the committee. And there is a second document. I just want to confirm, Chair, that we all have the responses. But there is a second document which is also part of it, which is titled Further Response to Questions and Comments. So.
Do we have it, members? Let's check on that. I think it was circulated yesterday, but let's check if members have it. I think we are okay now.
Chair, I just want to confirm that I'll be right in going straight to the further responses instead of going through the initial responses, because what had happened is that we provided responses to the comments as we got them, and we certainly did not answer them satisfactorily, so the need for us to further do the responses. And the first one is around clauses 32 and 55 of the bill. Basically, the query is in respect of land use restrictions and enforcement of land use schemes, there was a concern around what happens in rural areas or land use allocated by traditional authorities, traditional leaders, where whether people are protected by land use, where they use land not within land use schemes. Because in one section we're saying land use scheme must apply, in another section we're saying the municipality may seek enforcement of its land use scheme, including stopping the use of land contrary to its land use scheme. Our explanation, Honorable Chair, is that clause 32 of the bill recognizes two possibilities. One, it's land used in accordance with a scheme, either a land use scheme as in terms of this act, or a previous town planning scheme as we currently have it. The second possibility is land to which no scheme or no town planning or land use scheme applies. And then that takes us to the schedule to the bill, which then lists certain purposes for which land may be used. We believe that the land in the rural areas or the land users allocated by the chiefs will be covered in the second category. And in that respect, we believe that there is sufficient protection in the bill to make those uses, even though they are not in accordance with the land use scheme, to be lawful, as long as the purpose itself is within the schedule. And we believe that all land uses will fall within one or more of the schedules to the bill as it currently is. And to that extent, we're saying that a municipality may not, in terms of clause 55 of the bill, seek to stop the use of land for the purpose allocated by a traditional authority within the land, within the part of the municipal area. The second question is also very related to that, which is that what do we understand by the meaning of the word lawful as used in subclause 2 of our clause 32? We're saying that lawfulness in this instance means, almost like I've stated, lawfulness in accordance with the town planning scheme or a land use scheme, or lawfulness where there is no town planning scheme or a land use scheme in accordance with the purpose for which that land may be used before the commencement of this act, as long as it falls within the schedule of the act. And conversely, an unlawful use of land will mean land not in accordance with the town planning or a land use scheme, or not in accordance with the scheduled purposes in this bill where there is no land use scheme or town planning scheme. We also had a question on the impact of this bill on functions and activities of certain other departments. We were asked about the reactions of our department to this to what the reactions of this department and how we've dealt with it. In this response, we are saying that the first version of this bill was published very long ago in July 2001. We've had numerous meetings. In terms of the National Environmental Management Act, for instance, there's a Committee for Environmental Coordination, which seeks alignment between the environmental regime and all other laws having land use implications. We have presented the land use scheme to the Committee for Environmental Coordination in terms of the National Environmental Management Act. Suggestions have been made. Even the current version of the bill has reference to Section 24 of the NEMA Act. With regards to the Department of Provincial and Local Government, we've had numerous interactions with them because of their responsibilities for managing inter-sphere relationship and their regulatory role in that regard. They've made very useful comments. Quite a number of these comments, we've taken them on board. They were, of course, we've interacted with the Policy Coordination and Advisory Services Unit in the Presidency, with Minerals and Energy. We must state that the key concerns at national level or even across the sphere sometimes is our colleagues sometimes feel we should go more than we are presently going with the Land Use Management Bill. There is a school of thought which presupposes that we should have an overarching national legislation that governs beyond just land use, that deals with the question of land development, environmental consideration, and a couple of other matters. But these limitations are the way the Constitution allocates and distributes powers, and I would believe that what we are doing at the moment is what we can legally do, and as the nation progresses, we can look at further interaction and closer cooperation between environmental considerations and land use. But the reality is that people felt that the question of development should be closer to land use, then the question of mandate comes, whether we can legally do some of those things. Of course, our colleagues raised the question whether we have satisfactorily dealt with the complexity of the planning regulatory system. We believe we've made genuine attempts to address some of those issues. We probably will not kill all the problems in one single swoop. But this is our take that we've tried for the moment. A set of comments from our colleague, from our other departments, is more about how do we balance and temper the question of allocation of powers among the spheres of government. Some departments, of course, feel that municipalities, while the Constitution gives them so much powers, there is no capacity for them to do some of the things we wish them to do now. Some provinces want more powers. But what some people will be suggesting here will be the exact opposite of what the other people will be suggesting on the other side. So it's a delicate balance in terms of the role of national and provincial spheres in land use management system. There was a question, honorable members, on the indication of the Minister of Housing that there is no land available, and how will the Land Use Management Bill address this? We stated that there's a particular regime, if you look at the Physical Planning Act of 1967 and the Physical Planning Act of 1991, there was an approach to planning pre-1994, which was very, very technocratic. It was quite authoritarian. Presbyterian and the laws before 1994 were quite powerful for central administration. So to that extent, it has impact on the ground in terms of infrastructure, in terms of efficient use of large spaces and all these things. We must recognize that land is a limited resource. We can't produce more land. Of course, some countries do land reclamation. But we believe that while the Land Use Management Bill will not create more land, it has proposed tools. If we look at the special development framework that must be in existence before you do a land use scheme, it will talk to suitability index, it will talk to vacant land analysis, it will do special representation of desired land use patterns. We believe that these things will allow decision makers to know the best uses of land. So while we're not producing more land, it will assist us in efficiently manage in the efficient management of the available land that we do have. And with the existence of norms and standards, we believe that an efficient monitoring and evaluation framework, we believe that Minister of Housing and the whole housing sector will have a better opportunity to identify land for housing purposes. The next comment is that the department makes a sweeping statement about current legislation perpetuating special patterns under apartheid. And we were asked specifically whether or not we should not just adopt the Development Facilitation Act instead of bringing a new legislation to Parliament. With respect, we wish to state that our statement that the previous legislative or the current legislative framework perpetrate the previous special patterns is not sweeping, and we want to respectfully indicate that we have studies. The department has conducted assessment pattern studies. In our presentation, we had gone through some slides. If we look at our main presentation, we've done a settlement pattern study of major urban centers in the country, indicating that all the lofty policy goals, compact settlement, reduction of urban sprawl, and a couple of these ideas that the government has, between 1994 and 2002, at least when the studies were completed, we've realized that people are still located in far-flung settlements. Our cities are not getting compact. There's still huge transportation costs. The poorer are getting further from their places of work. So we believe that that's why the introduction of the DFA, that's why the introduction of new government since 1994, the settlement patterns are still going the same direction they were. People still live in the townships, some people still live in the cities, and we're not living together, we're not coming closer. There are no, the uses that land is being made of, they are not efficient in our view, at least according to the studies we've conducted. So to that extent, the department indeed considered whether or not the present laws must be adopted. We must say before we even respond fully that the main law in this regard at national level is the Development Facilitation Act. At the time the Development Facilitation Act was introduced in 1995, it was stated up front that it's an interim legislation. So to the extent that it is interim, to the extent that we've had 13 years after DFA, The idea behind the Land Use Management Bill was even created in the DFA itself. In the DFA set up a Development and Planning Commission, which was mandated. If we look at the chapter in the DFA, it set up a Development and Planning Commission to investigate this environment. Out of that DFA process, a green paper was enacted. The green paper recommended a new legislation. The white paper confirmed that view. So the Land Use Management Bill is a direct consequence of the DFA itself, and DFA itself gave back to it. And the further matter which is very crucial is that the previous legislation we have in this field, the Fiscal Planning Act of 67 and 1991, your DFA, your Left Former Township Establishment Act, and a host of legislation, many of them predated the transformation in the local government arena. We did not have wall-to-wall municipalities. We did not have the Systems Act, the Structures Act, the Property Rates Act, and a couple of legislation. So to that extent, we would just be doing patchwork if we allow this previous legislation to sit with the development in the local government arena. So we need a legislation which responds to the local government system as it is now. And perhaps lastly, the critical thing with the existing legislation is that there are serious questions around the constitutionality of certain provisions of the DFA. We had a judgment in Johannesburg in February this year, where, strangely, the city of Johannesburg was forced to take a matter to court, and the provincial government had to be on the other side than the national government, because we all found it necessary that we need to answer questions. Municipalities feel that the DFA mandates tribunals to do things which are constitutionally the mandates of municipalities. The DFA, as it is today, it is still in the law books. Western Cape never tried to even implement the DFA. There is no tool in the DFA that allows the national government to force its provisions on any part of the country. So we have a very nice DFA, which is not only toothless in one or two respects, it leads to unconstitutionality in another respect. It's interesting to even note that the DFA itself, whilst it is managed by the Minister of Land Affairs, if you look at Section 33 of the DFA, on the question of constitutionality, we have the tribunals who are able to suspend the operation of any other law when considering land development applications. We've had scenarios where the Minister of Agriculture had got opinions from legal officers in Department of Agriculture about the constitutionality of a law, and we have advised the Minister of Land Affairs, fortunately the same minister, of the constitutionality of that same provision. So we have this question of constitutionality of the DFA. And possibly lastly, is the institutional corruption in the DFA. The DFA creates tribunals which sit outside the municipalities. The municipalities will do their SDFs and their planning tools. The DFA tribunals can literally disregard these tools. So to that extent, it usurps the powers of municipalities. But there are quite a number of challenges with the existing legislative framework, and we submit that the desirable and the right thing to do is to bring in a new legislation to Parliament. The sixth question is about, we were also related to the previous one, that the DFA is a more comprehensive piece of legislation than the Land Use Management Bill. And that the impression is that the Land Use Management Bill is scanty on details, that there are chapters covered by the DFA not covered in the present Land Use Management Bill. In addition to the previous responses we've given, we're saying that we cannot replicate all what we have in the DFA in the present system, because some of the provisions of the DFA are already taken over in the Systems Act, in a couple of local government legislation. There is also need to recognize and empower the provinces to play distinct roles in this regard. But what we have done here, honorable members, is to do chapter by chapter analysis, what is covered in the present DFA and how we have dealt with it in the present Land Use Management Bill. We must admit that if we look at Chapter 2 of the DFA, we don't need the Development and Planning Commission again. What we do have is a National Land Use Commission. There are two specific areas where honorable members raised concerns that the DFA allows, creates procedures for development of small-scale farming, that it also has land tenure provisions. We must say that there is a bill being piloted by the Department of Agriculture on the Sustainable Utilization and Protection of Agricultural Resources Bill. The super bill deals with some of the elements of DFA, so we don't need to replicate it in the Land Use Management Bill. And we're also submitting that the question of initial ownership in the land tenure provisions in the DFA, we do not need them. They are actually hardly used in practice, so we have not made provisions for them. But broadly, we have done a comparison of the DFA and the Land Use Bill in these responses. Honourable members, there was a question around whether we should provide details on the composition of the Land Use Committees. We're told that what is common we're asked about the common practice, whether we're expecting three persons to sit on the Municipal Land Use Committee or more people. There was a concern around the power of the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the Municipal Land Use Committee, and we're told that the council may have extreme powers. We're told that qualifications and skills required for membership of the national of the municipal land use committee are not stated. Though we attempted to respond to this question before, but what we can safely add to the initial response that the bill in clause 9 provides for a minimum membership of 3 members and a maximum of 15 for the municipal land use committee. We believe that the concerns around the procedures are regulated in clause 60, 61, and 62 of the bill. The way we have structured this, we are proposing that the municipal land use committee may be able to delegate its power to smaller teams among themselves. So if they have 15 members in a committee, they can delegate the powers to one member, to 3 members, subject to the parameters proposed in the bill. In respect of the concern around possible abuse of powers by members of this committee, we are saying that there is a code of conduct for municipal officials as prescribed by the Municipal Systems Act. The bill further criminalizes members of the committee who have engaged in acts or omissions that violate clause 15.2b of the bill, which prescribes the manner that they must act. In particular, they must be credible, they must be impartial, they must avoid conflict of interest, they must act in good faith, they must be people of integrity. So in addition to the code of conduct, there is criminal sanctions for members of land use committee. I would believe this is sufficient to deal with the possibilities of abuse of power. In respect of qualifications for membership, which is dealt with in clause 10 of the bill, we have stated that it should be in land use or related matters. Our view is that it's nice to keep it the way it is, and the greater details of qualifications will be further regulated in the regulations. We believe that there is no need to be overly prescriptive in this regard. The next comment was on the financial implications, because we have stated that funds will be saved from mainstreaming multiple systems. We can say to Parliament that we have done a cost analysis of this bill. Because of the multiple institutions that exist at the moment, because of the multiple processes, as we have stated before, we have tribunals in many provinces sitting alongside tribunals. We have commissions somewhere. We have the boards. We have the municipal systems. Now we're not going to have those multiple sites of land development applications consideration. So we have submitted a document on the financial implications. We've done a study of what exists at the moment. And what we propose will likely be, we've looked at it in terms of rands and cents, and we are convinced that we will, it's a last attachment to this document. We believe that we'll be able to do some cost savings in this regard. Honourable members, there was a concern around our interactions with traditional leadership. We were asked, what did the traditional leaders say during consultations? In fact, we were asked specifically that what difficulties are we experiencing as a department in considering the proposals from traditional leadership. We just want to state the department consulted with the traditional leaders way back in 2001, which will be 3 months after the first version of the bill was submitted. We've got written comments from the National House, and we're able to trace one of the comments from the Northern Province House of Traditional Leaders. We've attached this comment to these responses. So we're glad to say that we've actually engaged our traditional leaders right from the start. We also want to report that in April of this year, the department made a presentation to the National House of Traditional Leaders here in Cape Town on the bill. We were advised by the National House that we must consult with a bigger gathering of traditional leaders. We indeed we did that in May. In May this year, we met with the leadership of the traditional leaders at provincial level and national level, Contralesa at national level and provincial level. We met in Durban, and we had very fruitful discussions of the bill. and that was on the 8th and 9th of May, and that there were resolutions that reached at this workshop of in May. We've attached copies of the resolutions there. We've attached it as an exhibit to this, and that will be guided by the committee in terms of how we incorporate this comments into the as amendments into the bill. There was another question on the meaning of the word office of trust as used in clause 11E of the bill. We believe that this office of trust will refer to somebody who holds and exercises powers in terms of a law. So possibly, I mean, most likely it would be public servant, a civil servant, or an official, not necessarily restricted to an appointment in terms of the Public Service Act. Honorable Chair, you said we should deal with the question of possible amendments. We're grateful to this House that the House pointed to us of a duplication in the bill. So we'll be, I think that's in respect of clauses 32 and 46. There was a bit of duplication where we'll be proposing amendments. Subject to the guidance of the Portfolio Committee, we will be seeking advice on how to incorporate the comments or the resolutions of the traditional leaders into the bill. And that there may be one or two other areas as time proceeds that will be formally submitting comments. Some of them are typographical in terms of at the heading of the Municipal Land Use Committee. We'll just be proposing how to refine it. But they are not substantive amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Any comment, please?
Yeah. Sunday has fairly covered what we had discussed in our task team, in our working team in the department. I can confirm that we didn't feel that this legislation is a planning legislation. It is a land use management legislation. So that's why we did not feel that we should go to the detail of doing in this bill what the provinces and municipalities in their supportive legislation could go into. So we felt that it is better to leave this legislation and confine it to land use management and not to include things that are like forward planning, which would be very detailed planning functions, which should be done by the municipalities. We still believe that the municipalities and the provinces should have relevant legislation or bylaws that would relate to the to this function, which would hang on this national legislation. That was our same view when we were discussing this. We have observed that in many municipalities, some of these functions are done by officials. That's why we had proposed in this bill that it must be the officials that must be members of the committee. But we've observed that in the Western Cape, councillors or elected officials, elected members, are the ones who are in this committee. So that practice is happening in the Western Cape. We would be guided by the committee if the committee would like to consider strongly the amendment of the term officials to elected representatives onto the committee. We would be open to that. But our view, as we have articulated in this, is that there is this code of conduct that guides these people and the qualifications of who should be in that committee. If the portfolio committee feels strongly that we should follow the example of the Western Cape and use elected officials, we are open to that amendment.
In fact, on the two last issues that you are raising, the charge is that the model that you have followed in terms of land use management bill, it's a Gauteng model. The old Transvaal model. So you're just you know, broadening it to the whole country. I'm saying it's a charge. But the second one confuses me. The DM is out. This is the DM who say this is a planning legislation. And you say it's not. If I take you to your presentation on the need for a new, on the need for the new act, slide number 5. I'm not sure to what extent does it reinforce what you say. Sunday?
Chair, thanks. Maybe I should, the attractiveness in the second one. May I start with the second concern around planning?
Okay.
Chair, in the 7 years or so that we've been developing these bills, we've had very useful interactions with other departments. In transport, they will tell you they do transport planning. Environmental management, they have what they call land use planners from environmental perspective. Minerals and energy, they also have planners. So the word planning has two senses, you can look at it, or multiple senses. You have the question of the broader one, the development planning, which is bigger. Then you have spatial planning, which is a subset of it. Then you have land use management, which you can also call land use planning. But here, if you look at this slide 5 that we're referring, that you have referred us to, we said the continued operation of these multiple pieces of planning laws. It is true, planning laws. Planning laws will then range from land use planning to municipal planning to a range of planning issues. The interaction. Land use planning has a role to play, or land use management has a role to play in there. The suggestions would be that we do not have the mandate, that is it desirable at this stage, to regulate the whole of the planning spectrum, because then it will probably lead us to a call to say, do you merge many other departments together? So you are right in saying to us that we have used planning here, and DG is saying that we are only doing land use. I will consider that we have used the word planning in relation to what we are doing here, land use management, as also planning. But there are broader and different levels of planning. So to that extent, some of the charges against us is that we have not done enough. It is very true that we cannot do as far as it is desirable.
So the long and short of it, just to summarize what you are saying, is that there is a multiple piece of planning laws that exist, which render the entire planning system inefficient, confusing, and costly. We'll still continue post-LAMP because LAMP is not a planning legislation.
Yeah, it is a planning legislation.
But it is not that planning that covers the whole of this field. And one of the accusations that has been leveled against us is that we have not even repealed all the laws that we should be repealing. And the answers are very clear. We all know the ideal state. The ideal state is to bring all these laws and put them in one single piece, repeal all laws, but we don't have the powers to. And not all of them are not necessarily able to sit in one legislation. They cannot. So we are repealing the key ones. We have proposed we do with the Fiscal Planning Act. We are proposing we do with the Removal of Restrictions Act. But constitutionally, and I think we will then submit those to the state law, we cannot repeal even some laws that have been assigned to the provinces. We cannot repeal provincial legislation. But that's why we are seeking Parliament to introduce this bill as a Section 76 bill, as a bill relying on 44(2) of the Constitution and Section 146(2) of the Constitution, so that even though we're not repealing all the laws, it will have a suppressing effect on all other laws if they are inconsistent with these laws. So provinces will make more laws. They will need to repeal their old laws first. But they will be able to make other laws insofar as they are consistent with this. So Chair, you are right. We're not repealing all the laws, but we can't repeal all the laws. But all those laws that will be remaining after this bill will be consistent with this. And that's our widow's mind.
Yep.
Now, Chairperson, just to suggest to the committee that perhaps a copy of Section 946 should be circulated to the members. All the members have got a copy of the Constitution, I presume, but it would be useful if that could be circulated, just that Section 946, because that's the understanding of concurrency in Schedules 4 and 5. It is not a provincial matter in Schedule 4 that's listed. It's a concurrent matter. Just as well as, say, agriculture. It's not a provincial matter. It's a concurrent function. In other words, it can be done by both provincial as well as national sectors of government, spheres of government. So what comes into effect is the standards and norms overriding in terms of Section 146. This is supposed to bring a cooperative system about, because at the moment there isn't cooperation. The national sphere is not in the land use planning management, land use management. And it is, planning will still happen in terms of the national perspective, in terms of provincial strategies, in terms of independent municipal planning, it will still happen. But this will create a tractor and plow with which you can put it into effect and have one system for South Africa. Just that at this stage. Thank you.
The first question around the Gauteng model, with respect to our colleagues, is quite interesting and attractive. We're dealing with multiple systems, Chair, and we have to advise the Parliament whether or not we are right in our assumption that there is need to introduce a uniform system in the country. Because the same argument will go.
The issue is which system.
I will not think we're inspired. We're inspired by a national debate as encapsulated in the white paper on land use. It was a national debate. All provinces took part in it. We had common agreements. Whichever way we go, Chair, we will still tilt probably towards one province or one system. But the reality is that if we take the issue of whether or not we should use elected officials or politicians to take land use decisions, depending on which country you go, both systems apply. Because people tell us that land use decisions are essentially political decisions. So you must have councillors take that decision of land use decision, micro application. The other view is, why don't you allow the politicians to set the parameters within which officials take those decisions, and then remove officials and remove politicians from micro application making? But we've had systems, not only in Western Cape, where truly politicians have been involved in land use decisions as decision makers. And what we think is closer to the consensus is that policy setting should be politicians' work. Micro application, change of use, and all those things, leave it to officials to do. They must do it within guided parameters. As set out by the political principles, we will be guided by your thinking. But we don't want to necessarily say it is closer to Gauteng, because we had even that model they were talking about, and we were overwhelmed by the responses in the consultation process to say, guys, remove councillors from this mess. It won't be helpful. Thank you, Chair.
Remove councillors, but include the minister.
Chair, that's also another attractive allegation that we have brought the minister in. We are saying that at national level, very limited and circumscribed responsibility for the minister. She's not a primary land use regulator. The minister hopefully will not have a right to consider an application de novo from start. But what we are saying is that in very limited cases where national interest permits, the minister should. But the minister will only exercise that power on the advice of the National Land Use Commission. She will not wake up in the morning and say, no, this is what I want to happen on this road. And that National Land Use Advisory Commission is going to be big. It's going to have people across the board. We can look at the refining subject to your directives on how the minister should exercise their powers. But we have not made the minister a functionary in the sense of a micro land use application decision making. I think.
Let me make another charge. In a sense, I think the reason why we've been running on the same spot for the past 7 years is because, you know, submissions that other people made were not taken into account. I'm saying that because, you see, I listen to you, and, you know, I followed even your responses to the questions that these members raised with you. And I see that the best you can do is to explain yourself. Those don't even result in some of the views being carried into what you'd consider as amendments. So that's my charge. But otherwise, members, let me take hands. Honourable Porter.
Honourable Jay, are we going to entertain, just as an introduction, are we going to entertain the proposal that this whole bill is rejected because we're going to start from scratch? Or are we going to go ahead and have hearings and continue with the bill? I think the first question we have to decide before I raise anything else with you. Can you give us a decision on that?
In fact, that's where we should have started. When I made reference to the letter from COSATU, let me not respond now. Let me hear what Mr. Larry say. Yeah. No, before we go to your question.
No, this time around you're wrong.
No, I know they are comrades.
No, this time around you're wrong. Yeah, you see, Chair, you see, the view that is expressed by Democratic Alliance to say you, it is not you, we as a committee. You are not taking a decision, we are taking a decision. I want you to correct the first that point. Secondly, my view, which I think I express the views of other comrades perhaps, is that the matter of the letter from COSATU at this stage is noted, and we proceed with the program as planned. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Lord.
Can I just provide a position also in the question that was posed? Because the bill has already been accepted by the Speaker and also the Chairperson of the NCLP, it has now been referred to the committees, and the only position that can be taken is that the committee deals with the bill, and then once they've gone through the whole process, then they decide as to their recommendation, whether they want the bill to be rejected or to be made with amendments or whatever other provision that they will make. And only once the bill goes back to the houses again, and then that decision to either reject and not handle the bill at all can be made.
I think that summarizes. Yep. So let's proceed and see what life will lead us to. If it commits suicide in the process, hard luck.
We won't kill it. Honorable Botha.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I would like to thank the presenters. Thank you very much for your presentation once more. And welcome, particularly Mr. Gwanya. Nice to have you here. Besides the Minister, nice to have Deputy Minister, nice to have you here too. I would like to start with the issue that we're dealing with right at the end here now, and that is the establishment of land use committees. And I'd like us to go to the bill in Chapter 3, where it says under Clause 8.2, members of the Municipal Land Use Committee are appointed by the executive authority of the municipality. And then I want to take us back to Clause 4E, where it says under directive principles, the principle of fair and good governance to promote land use management measures that are taken timeously and in a democratic, participatory, and lawful manner. Now, those two clauses to me, absolutely exclusive, totally contradictory. How can the members of a land use committee be appointed by the executive, and that be regarded as a participatory matter? It's not only there. We come back to that issue again. But in the meantime, when we go further to the composition of the committee, it says there that not less than three, under 9B, not less than three and not more than 15 members, and at least three of whom must possess appropriate qualifications. Now, in 9A, it says the chairman and deputy chairman who must be senior staff members of municipality. Well, I don't know how many senior staff members of municipalities throughout the rural parts of this country have those qualifications that we're talking about here. So I think we are dealing here with a bit of a fantasy. While it's all very good and well to say that at least three members must have qualifications, if there are only three members and two of them are these senior staff members, where are the qualifications? Where are they coming? I'd like that to be considered, not that to be answered finally in this matter here now. Then it says persons who are not public service officials or in the employ of the municipality may be appointed as non-voting members. I'd like to have the thinking behind that. While it was said here a moment ago that, you know, obviously you can have politicians, or you can have officials, or you can have politicians directing officials, whatever the case may be. But what is the idea of having non-voting members on a committee? I don't understand that. Then it goes to qualifications. And it says a member of a committee must, under 10C, possess appropriate qualifications or experience in land use and related matters, or any relevant qualifications, skills, or experience as prescribed. Once again, I think it's a contradiction that we have here between this one and 9B, where it refers to three people, two who must be the senior members, and then prescribed qualifications. Then I would like to turn to page 10. Under clause 21.2, the Premier must establish a nomination panel of persons to conduct a selection process of prospective tribunal members. We come back again to clause 4E, where we talk about participatory and democratic processes. How can that clause possibly qualify as a democratic and a participatory process? And then I think the last issue I'd like to raise with you at this stage is on page 19. Where it says the proceedings of a land use regulator other than, clause 58, 1 and 2. Proceedings of a land use regulator other than deliberations of its members are to be held in public. Well, obviously, I think it should obviously held in public. But then we often get this rider in bills and legislation. Two says, despite this provision, land use regulator may, on good grounds, exclude the public from its proceedings. Now, it doesn't say what the good grounds are. It doesn't say who's going to decide on the good grounds. It doesn't say, by what authority or how this can be challenged by the public in that particular case, in that particular community. And I think that kind of thing should at all costs be avoided. I think if there is very good reason to have a thing like that in secret, so to speak, there must be a very, very stringent requirements to justify such behavior. I don't think it can be willy-nilly just said, despite this, if they so wish, they can have it on good grounds. Because the good grounds will be decided by the committee. And, to come back to the presentation where it says, the elected people or officials, a democracy is not an army. An army loves usurping more and more power to the top and less power to the donkey who has to carry the guns at the bottom. And a democracy cannot function that way. The moment the democracy goes in that direction, it ceases to be a democracy, it becomes an army. And I think we must avoid that at all costs. We must go back to 4E at all times. And in any cause of behavior, it must be participatory and it must be democratic. I think I want to stop at this stage of that because I think what we would like to have from our side is to hear the presentations over the next 2 days and then for the committee to come to decisions after that. But I'd like while the presenters are here today just to deal more broadly with the issue. You dealt with the issue about to concentrate on officials or to concentrate on elected people and the sort of thinking behind that. I heard you and I understand you, but I would like to know the thinking in this bill. As the chair said, the one is a Gauteng model. Now, I'm a Free Stater, and Gauteng always makes me worry, but Johannesburg is a dangerous place. It's by a bung for I black. So I'd like to know what the thinking is in those specific questions I asked. How can it be stated here that we want democratic participatory situation and then have these very authoritarian decisions made by a very small number of people or one single individual? Thank you.
You can respond and we'll take Mr. Van Niekerk afterwards.
Thanks, Chair. We just want to state that we agree that Clause 4 is central to what we want to do in this bill. To have a democratic system, to have a participatory manner. What we just need to explain is that we hope that democracy is not only limited to where people are elected. It's, in our view, we'll be saying that the elected representatives of the people themselves, like the councillors, if they have to appoint a municipal land use committee, ensures that the broader segment of the society are afforded the opportunity to participate in nominating people to sit on the Land Use Management Committee. Not everybody will be able to make it to the committee, but I think it's about the opportunity to that is created to allow people to nominate, to allow people to sit on it, as opposed to a system which is closed to the greater majority of the people. So our view, and I will be guided by the committee, is that there is no contradiction in the constitution of the Municipal Land Use Committee, where we're saying that if 15 people are going to sit on the committee in a municipality, the job of the executive authority is to ensure that how do we make sure that the process for getting people to sit there is inclusive, is participatory, it represents the structure of the society. And in that way, we believe that it is democratic, because we believe that the decisions taken by the elected representatives of the people, the councillors, are themselves expression of democratic will of the people. And I would believe that the participation of the broader segment of people on the committee will equally reinforce what we are suggesting in four. But if we go back to look at the distinction between Clause 9.1b and Clause 9.2. We're talking about membership of the Municipal Land Use Committee in Clause 9-1. And within that membership, there are two levels. The first level is officials of the municipality. We're just saying that we must make a bit of a distinction between members of the committee as provided for in sub 1 of clause 9 and non-members as provided for in sub 2 of 9. But before I go to what is provided for in sub 2 of 9, let's first look at 9 sub 1. 9 sub 1 creates two categories. The first category is those of officials. And we can remove the word senior. But what we are saying is that there should be clear case of officials employed by the municipality to do land use decisions sitting on this board. Minimum 3. Then we're saying there's no restriction on how you get the other 12. The minimum thing is I get some of them to have experience in land use. Those are the members of the committee. In 9 sub 2, those are not members of the committee. In the sense of the fact that they are not voting. We can define it, but what we are saying there is that we may get these people as technical advisors, people who need to render specific duties, particularly in respect of a specific application. We will be advised on what to do. But our idea is to create a class of voting members who are real members of the committee, and another class of possible non-voting members. With regards to, I think the concerns are similar when we get to, I believe, clause 21 of the bill. And which page is that?
While he's looking for that, Chairperson, could I just say one sentence here for the Honorable Buerta? You must, for example, read what your questions have been about the councillors or officials with sections 47 and 48 on page 60. There you see the democratic applications and further. And for example, on your question regarding where do you in a faraway rural town get the people to the officials of this level, just look at the support systems in chapter 2 from page 7. The point which I wish to make is one should read a lot of these sections together with other sections. This is the type of law which the whole law must be read, and cross-references is underlying it. Thank you.
The Deputy Minister, just explain what he's referring to the other clause we can read together. Just explain to us more clearly, please.
Oh, no. If you go, for example, to page 16 and at chapter 4, land use schemes under section 47 refer to what your executive authorities, like your municipal council, must do, what their role is. They must, in the development, preparation, and amendment for its land use schemes, provide general policy and other guidance to these regulators. In providing such guidance, they must monitor, and to the extent provided in this Act, other laws on the administration of the municipal sphere. That refers, for example, to the Systems Act, the Structures Act, and the municipal, amongst others. They must oversee such responsibility as it may assign to officials of such municipality. In other words, these officials sitting on the regulator, they can't be loose cannons. Now, democracy is playing its general role here by supervising them. And in section 48, the scheme that comes every now and then, it must be reviewed, must be adopted by the municipality as further. A single scheme or different schemes together, but it is under political control. Just as much as to appoint these high officials around the stable, not for all of them we had the whole parliament sitting to appoint national officials. But it's basically that process, that thinking, and that specific way in which democracy works, which is applied in this law. That's why I say your questions are valid in itself, but it must be read with the broader aspects of this law. But the officials will explain further. Thank you. We will come to those sections as well.
Okay. Yeah. Other members, regarding the question on the appointment process for tribunals, page 10, that's clause 21. We just want to say that we believe that if we read this provision, we thought that we've attempted to create a very transparent process that allows for public selection of tribunal members. We are saying that the premier must not just appoint. The premier must first constitute a panel to advertise, to call for nominations, to do the selection process, and this panel will then recommend to the premier. And the premier is just an appointing authority. So it insulates the decision process from this accusation that people are just appointed. It creates a avenue for, if we look at it, it says 21 sub 6, says whenever it is necessary to appoint a member of a tribunal, an MEC responsible for land use management or special planning functions in the province, designated by the premier, must, through advertisements in the media, circulating nationally and in the province, invite nominations, together with the nomination panel, shortlist prospective persons recommended to be tribunal members from the received nominations, recommend to the premier persons qualified for appointment. So we're saying that the appointment process is actually, we thought it would be saying that it's a bit expanded, and that it will not just allow the premier to appoint anybody willy-nilly. And even after the appointment, when this tribunal does anything it's doing, we must look at the chapter on the process, especially if we look at clause 44 of the bill. It tells us there are very clear guidelines that will enable a tribunal, a municipal land use committee, or anybody taking a land use decision to do things properly as we wish them to do. And overall, this act will still be read with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, so that to the extent that people's rights are affected, we must follow due process in that decision making. So we want to advise that we believe we have created a system which allows inclusiveness, democracy, participation, and the key element of equity and fairness in both the selection process, in both the decision making, and the possible outcomes. Thanks, Chair.
Maybe before I go to Honorable Van Nickel, the floor address, I want to say something. Okay.
Yep. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I actually also wanted to supplement what my colleague Sandy has stated, that if you look at clause 9 and clause 29, perhaps we could accept that on clause 9, we went short on making the provision that the process actually starts at the advertisement stage, where nominations are called from whoever. Anyone who wants to provide someone to be nominated as a nominee for this committee, then they can do so. However, in clause 9, I think that part is sort of lacking, and it only comes at the last stage where the executive authority must come in and appoint. But the process where it all starts is not covered in clause 9, whereas clause 21 then is looking at that issue of bringing in this participative democracy by calling on to anyone, but then the process has to be narrowed down by having the panel that after all the nominations received, that we have to sift through them and then select who is best suited to be in these committees and also in the tribunal. That's all I wanted to point out, Chair. Thank you.
Okay.
Just very shortly, we'll obviously come back to this later, and I don't want to hold up the committee on the issue here, but I think I must make myself very, very clear here. Thank you very much for the Lord Visor there, that indeed I fully agree. The 9 is very lacking there, and I don't see the 21 makes any provision that 9 must be dealt in any different manner. 9, I think, is quite clear. There is no a nomination process there. It's the executive decides finish and last. But even under 21, the 21.2, and that was my issue, and that's the issue I raised, and I don't think it was answered, is that the Premier must establish a nomination panel. Nobody helps the Premier to establish a nomination panel. Nobody nominates anybody on the nomination panel. It's the Premier that determines the nomination panel. That, and we've got lots of experience in our country and elsewhere in the world, I'm not playing politics here now, that is not democratic. That does not answer to 4E. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that part will resolve. that part will resolve. We'll deliberate it next week. Sunday?
I just wanted to suggest that we may have a very endless process if we keep asking who nominates who. Because it's not the panel, it's just an advice you want. But maybe I should leave it there, Chair.
Yeah. The similar point I was making the other time that, as ANC, we go to elections and win elections. When we come back, we establish independent this and independent that. Take away the power that the electorate has given us. So, yeah. But on my side, the disqualification, the clause 11, the 11A, What do we define as a political office bearer? What is that? What is that? Because it's not even defined.
Just trying, yes.
It
may be a ranking party official who is not a municipal councillor or a MPL or a national MP or something of that kind. But he is just a secretary of Western Cape Democratic Alliance, and he runs the office here. Whoever. Fortunately, I don't know that structure. But I mean, something I think that may be intended, but then it must be clear.
Sally, what is this?
Yeah, we'll seek advice, but we want to believe that a political office bearer is somebody who holds office linked to a political party.
You don't say anything.
I'm just saying that it's not necessarily elected official. It will mean a non-elected person who is not, in terms of the Public Service Act, for instance, where we're looking at a chairperson of a political party or somebody who holds office, which is very linked to a political party.
Well, I'm a deputy chairperson of a branch.
Yeah, that would be a political office.
I'm an additional member in my branch.
We've got to.
No.
We will refine our thoughts, Chair. We'll come back.
Okay. Because you see, the problem with this thing is that. With a program such as Limpopo where everybody is ANC. So, and if when people nominate people,
know, they always look at that leadership for this responsibility. Now the consequence is that they are going to unfairly deny people to be led. So let's crack this thing. Exactly what is it that we want to mean? Honorable Fadigat.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be short. It's just a question for information. But first, could I just get clarity again? On the 6th of August, we're not going to have the land bank, are we? We're not going to have the land bank on the 6th of August anymore. Are you sure?
19th of August.
The land bank, yeah. So it's gone from us. No, okay. Now, the question is... yeah, fine. Come on. The question which I would like to is to get clarity. You see, with this committee, land use and planning, that's a fertile area for financial abuse for people. Yeah, everywhere. Well, I can take you to the Eastern Cape as well. So let's leave that out. But that is what we're trying to establish clarity so that you can minimize that abuse which has been made by developers and whatever. That is actually the basic reason for this. But now, the question that I'd like is, we have now three basic spheres of authority. National cabinet, provincial, and then you have the municipal structure. What does each of them do? And how do they coordinate? This is where I haven't got the full clarity in my mind. How does the national ministries, and it's not only one, it would be agriculture and water and forestry and everyone who has inputs into how land should be used. How do they define, or how does that structure, could we have a chart of what are the functions of each so that we can get a coordinated action of a municipality at the bottom, and that one municipality next to the other one cannot have totally different norms applied in practice. Let's have an clarity of what you from the department see each of these spheres have to do, and please, I think that will ease a lot out of my mind as to, and I think it would clarify also a number of questions that will come along time. But please, don't give it now. Give it to us later on paper, please.
Okay. I don't know if there are more hands. Okay. Yep.
Just one observation. I think fundamentally we must, as national parliament, think on one thing. Did what we have at moment really give us the spatial transformation that we should have had by this time? And my answer is no. And that is all the economic effects of the real spatial patterns in South Africa. I wouldn't say it's wrong in Cape Town or wrong in Gauteng or in Johannesburg or in Bothaville or wherever, but it didn't as such. It was in fact open. It became a system of consultants, especially in smaller towns, and it became a system of lobbying. And that's why I really don't think it would be right to put these powers in the hands of councillors to be lobbied like that. But that they have the function to control. But I just want to say, in the end, Chair, we must think of how are we going to change what we have at the moment in South Africa. And for that we need a tractor and a plough. And this is what this is supposed to be, this law. it will take time to build out all the norms and to get the practices settled. We've got some strong senators. So, Itiquini has got a strong municipality. It's normally where there are strong municipalities. Even places like Bloemfontein has got a reasonable planning capacity. But the big thing is we are neglecting certain parts of the country. And that's the only message I have. That's why I think we must go this way. And we're still listening to the arguments. Thank you, sir.
Chair, could I just respond by saying that from the Democratic Alliance side, we need order in this whole action. So we support it. But it's a question of the particulars and the finer details that we are arguing at the moment. So we're not against this whole restructuring and getting things back into position. But it is how it's being done. And that is where you must tolerate some of our questions.
Yeah. Well, I suppose also part of the equation is whether this bill, you know, is there any articulation between its objectives and what it seeks to achieve and how it's drafted, you know. Will it achieve what it seeks to achieve? Exactly. Or is it a second-hand tractor, you know? Honorable Dali?
Maybe, Chair, following what the DM has indicated, perhaps in terms of maybe the department and maybe from his office, trying to look at this question which is raised by my comrade. My brother, cry. You know, my brother, cry. If you look at page 7, other norms and standards, I'm just trying to think aloud, perhaps, that you've got 5C perhaps, but let's start with 5A, 5 sub 1, subject to the minister must determine a prescribed compulsory norms and standards. Compulsory norms and standards. I'm looking perhaps, that's what I'm saying, I'm just thinking aloud, and read to this 5-2C. Standardize the compilation of all maps and diagrams at the appropriate scale. I'm just trying to think in terms of that five. Whether, you see, is there any way where the minister, in terms of the norms and standard, is then able to say, municipality A, you will do certain things, and municipality B and C, you will do exactly in terms of what Municipal B is doing. I'm trying to get that back in terms of saying maybe we need to avoid a situation where a municipality A will do certain things which will not be combined in terms of what Municipal E and D are doing. That's number one. Number two, I think with the understanding of what is taking place at the local government sphere at this stage, I mean, there's no doubt that the worst management use land corruption is taking place at local level, the worst one that we have never seen. So I'm trying to say in terms of making sure that the developers, because the culprits are developers at the end of the day, the developers, they will approach Ward Councillor A to say, listen, man, I've got that piece of land which I can do better for your community. They usually use the word your community, you know, to uplift your community or whatever. Then the poor Ward Councillor A, not knowing exactly what needs to be done, says, oh, fine, it's very good. I can build a few houses there, you know, for you. And those houses are going to be built in that particular area. The poor Ward Council is thinking that they're going to build houses for the people. But at the end of the day, that particular developer is trying to make money out of those houses. You build about 100 to 200 houses, and that is no longer the municipality responsibility now. That developer has bought that land. The council has got nothing to do. It's a property owned by an individual. Being those houses, how people are located, it's not even the municipality is involved. It is that individual saying, that house has got 1.2 million, that house has got 3 million, and all those things. Now, the very people that have been identified by that particular individual, when he went to that particular councillor, then he's gone. I think what has happened in your Eastern Cape, Wild Coast, you know, is the Wild Coast. That the, unfortunately, with due respect to the traditional leadership, others were just selling with a bottle of wine, a bottle of brandy, and all those things, you know. So I'm saying, in terms of this, maybe we need to try to really guard against that, that eventuality, you know. Thank you.
Okay. Is it? Sunday? Okay. So they're fine with the comments. Honorable members, the I think this takes care of the presentation by the department. We are starting tomorrow at what time? 10 o'clock up until 4 or 5-ish tomorrow. V475. I think it's a much nicer, comfortable venue. Yeah. I hope all of us have got the program for tomorrow. No, today we've got nothing for the... Yeah, it was all in the department. Yeah. No, I wanted to give you time to go and read the submissions. Lunch here. We don't have a sit-down lunch. You know, Parliament is bad at hosting.